XRT. Spin up all missiles.
Thing, Hire.
No kidding. I almost got up and ran. Battle Station, brother.
Battle Station. Man, Battle Station Missile. It's the WSRT. It's the Sub-Vets. I'm Gary.
And I'm Eric.
And special guest today, Dave Anderson. Dave is in, I think you're in North Carolina, but I'm not absolutely sure of that.
Oak Island, just below Wilmington on the coast.
There you go. So Dave's joining us today because somebody, not pointing any fingers or naming any names, but it rhymes with Bade, was complaining that we weren't having any fast attack guys on. So, Bade, we got your fast attack guy. There he is. Two fast attacks, one boomer, right?
Yes, sir. If you call Apache a fast attack, we're kind of more along the lines of a slow approach.
Well, I thought those boats were fast, man.
It was a 637, but when you throw a 100-foot plug in it, you don't go as fast as you used to.
Well, I always heard it was like the Wonder Woman show from back in the 70s, like her plane was invisible. The part you just went invisible. You never saw it in port, didn't see it. Just saw dudes walking down into the water.
That's right. Once we submerged, you didn't find us.
I know exactly where she is.
Yes, sir.
Like 7 miles from here.
At least the sail and all the ribbons, that's for sure.
Go down there quite a bit. Well, Dave, we're glad you're with us today. We're going to talk a little bit about your career. We're going to talk about some stuff that's got Eric excited again, because everything we talked about last week within 24 hours was in the news. So it's almost like the newspapers are listening to our show. That must be what's happening.
We had premonitions from the ether. Anyways. Hey, by the way, Dave, I want to say, not only did I get our audience fast attack, I got us fast attack extraordinaire. Hey, Dave, can you show them that American tattoo on your arm, man?
I wear my dolphins and my flag everywhere it goes. So,
got a God bless America right there, brother. God bless America.
That's right.
Dave, tell us a little bit about your life, your career path as you joined today. We were talking in the pre-show about you going to boot camp in Orlando. I always love it when we've got a Mustang here. And so tell us a little bit about your career.
So two failed years of college and killing a couple of cars. I remembered the nuke recruiter talking to my parents when I was 18 and decided I was going to grow up and join the Navy. Walked in recruiting station, said I want to be an electrician, nuke on submarines, and away I went. August 87, Orlando boot camp, followed the pipeline after that. EMA school there in Orlando, power school. Leaving out of power school, tried to get to Connecticut for a prototype with all my buddies from power school. Was drawn out of the hat to go to Idaho Falls. Hated it until I pulled into Idaho Falls. Loved it while I was there. It's a great time. It was there. Got picked up as a staff. But I talked to the projects detailer about the Parchy, and those orders take precedence. So thank goodness, I got the privilege, I should say, of getting to go to USS Parchy, SSN 683. Joined her in June of '89. Did the conversion overhaul for the 100-foot plug edition. Anybody out there sees a picture of Parchy or whatever right before she was decommissioned, you'll see the plug in the front end. It's basically looks like your missile deck behind your head there, Dave, but on the forward part of the ship in front of the sail. And Parchy Special Projects Platform, there 4 years. We did all the overhaul stuff, all the post-overhaul testing of all the special equipment, and I was there through June of '93. I walked off board to go be a instructor in Orlando right before she went on the mission in '93. It was a 123-day submerged mission for the guys that got the Parchy, one of her 9 presidential unit citations. A school instructor 2 years. That's where I found out about the old enlisted commissioning program. So got to go back to school, get my commission, went back through power school in Orlando again, JO tour in Wyoming, did a prototype stint as an instructor, grad school, because I volunteered to go to prototype, which a lot of officers didn't. Then after grad school, department head tour on USS Greenville, 2006 to 2008, note dates, that's after her four accidents from 2002 until about 2004.
We'll get to that later.
I joke and tell people that as a navigator on Greenville, I only hit dry dock blocks. So we did Greenville's navigator. Then I did a post-department head tour in Hawaii at working for SUPAC, and then retired 2010. So a little over 10 years sea time, and then almost 13 years between duty stations, instructor, that kind of stuff. So
let's go back for just a minute to that 130 whatever days it was for the Parchi special mission. Now, as I recall in my copious free time of reading, isn't that the mission where they went into like Vladivostok or something, and they picked up the chairman of the KGB who was defecting to the United States because Jack Ryan had turned him?
Yes,
brought him back to
back out. They picked up the a few other like down pilots and things, all right. That stuff in between, right. All the swim calls in the bathtubs and the whirlpools that we put in that 100-foot section. That's how all that happened.
While they were tapping phone lines and yada, yada, yada.
The Parchi went through the Parchi did go through several modifications, and you said you were part of like one of those, and the hole kept extending. And that's when they put the swimming pool in, right? The spa and stuff, that's when they put that in.
100 foot. Bowling alleys, swimming pools, and leisure activities.
Man, good. That's good duty. Great duty. Right. Man, why didn't I go fast attack? Dang it.
Right. So we kind of give you a side note story. We did a reunion. That's what this shirt is. Last September in Charleston for the Parchi. Had 150 guys from commissioning through decommissioning. Our CO at the time was Admiral Ben Wachendorf. He was CO for the conversion.
Boy, say that twice.
Mare Island, and you know the conversion. He sent a video. He didn't get to come down. He sent a video, and he holds up this big giant bottle of vodka. So at some point after he became an admiral, he was part of a liaison attempt in which we sent DSRV units out to help the Russians find a downed submarine. Okay, so in the post time frame after that, one of the head admirals for the Russian submarine fleet met Admiral Wachendorf, presented him with a big giant bottle of vodka, and in the video, you know, the Russian admiral asked him about being where he shouldn't be, and he said, "Well, I can't tell you any of all that," but the Russian admiral said, "Just so you know, we were actively searching for you the whole time. And we basically had orders, if we found you, to shoot," kind of thing. So just kind of one of those funny stories, you know. Admiral Wachendorf laughed about it with that Russian admiral, that kind of thing. But many years later, people still remember and still talk about the things that Parchi did. So,
yeah, I'm enough of a second-class petty officer that I would have looked at that Russian admiral and said, "Well, obviously you didn't find us."
That's right. My gosh. I don't know if I could use his name, but there's a gentleman. I got him as part of the subvet group. He posts mainly over on Twitter. I use some of his photographs. He works for I don't know if he worked for him anymore, but he did work for a UK company. And he was interfacing with a lot of Russian submariners and, you know, officer COs, getting all kinds of stories. And, you know, the interesting thing that I got out of him is, you know, when you get to talking to him, they're just people that have families and thought they were doing the right thing. Just like us. And here we go. We were going at it, you know, with our finger on the switch, ready to blow each other up. You know, it's incredible. But, you know, a lot of Russians here in Denver, great people, by the way. So I know we got a lot of things going on with Ukraine right now, but, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, people are people. Yeah, we got to look at it that way. Yeah, it's a good story, though, you have there with the cap, the Admiral.
So you ended up on the Wyoming. What was that like for you?
JO tour and learning the whole missile compartment world was fairly exciting. We did a FSET, follow on command exercise, something like that, where you take weapons, pull in, you go into the dry dock, they take weapons off, they take the warheads off, put telemetry data warheads on the missiles. And then you go out to sea and you go through launch sequencing and you actually, launch actual Trident missiles. We launched two. Was kind of neat because,
that's big fun.
Oh, yeah, it was. Well, after we did, I was one of the two officers or whatever that broke the code. You break the little cookies, blah, blah, blah. You go out, talk to the captain. You authorize the weapons launch. Exactly. There you go.
That's like movie star stuff right there, man. That's like Crimson Tide.
Heck, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. So after we did that, we go through the launch sequence or whatever. So I decided, well, where do I want to be for these two weapons going off? So I went to, middle level where you had the viewing window in one of the tubes. I watched one eject, and then went down to lower level and hugged the gas generator when the second one went off. So it was pretty cool. Yeah. Just
I was going to tell you, as a former member of the Naval Ordnance Test Unit, over 30 weapons downrange, the best spot is hugging that tube if you can get there. It is an experience. It's equivalent to bungee jumping, and I never bungee jump, but I'm pretty sure it's like that.
And, of course, I have to completely disagree. Having launched four of them myself as a fire control supervisor, I can tell you that's the best place to be.
Come on.
Funny part about, Parchy didn't go anywhere. So, back in those days, you had to listen to all the chiefs and their Philippine stories and this, that, and the other. Then you go to a Trident. Trident's not really going anywhere. We got to go to Halifax one time. So that, the liquor dome in Halifax was a little bit of fun, but, nothing like the old stories. And then obviously on Greenville, we did a Westpac. So we got to go places then. So,
speaking of the Greenville, obviously that has some history with hitting that Japanese, I can't even remember the name of the boat.
Himimaru.
And I tell you what, and we've brought this up on the podcast before, the USS Wyoming had a little bit of history before Dave got there too, that I might have, may or may not have been a part of. Just saying, we won't say anymore, but seems like history seems to follow you, and you get to do a lot of lessons learned when you get to the boat, So what can you talk about the Greenville about, what happened, how the crew was acting with that?
Greenville, when I got there in June of 06 was, they're still in the throes of poor command morale, that kind of stuff like that, right? They were kind of the redheaded stepchild of PAC fleet, because in 2002 they started with the Himimaru. They had the grounding, they had two collisions within a 2-year period, and if you looked at the command plaque outside the CO stateroom with all the all the COs over a 2-year period, there were four captains that were on Greenville. Scott Waddle was the first, and he was, he was relieved. The other two COs for the first collision and the grounding, they were relieved. And then at the time, Commander Lee Haney was the fourth, but he surface transit and a Navy surface ship hit him. And they basically said there was nothing submarine could do to get out of the way or whatever. So he wasn't relieved in that collision, which is kind of unheard of or whatever, but had they relieved him, by the time I would have gotten there, what kind of morale would the ship have had? It was bad when I got there.
That's my question for you. Coming in there as, this was your department head tour, as I recall?
Yes, navigator.
What, from a leadership standpoint, okay, so you've come from an enlisted position to a department head navigation. How do you deal with that? What did you do that worked? What did you find that didn't work?
So all of my underweight poopy suits and stuff like that, I had enlisted dolphins stitched on the inside of my poopy suits and that kind of stuff, and And I just try to take care of my guys. You know, I try to take care of the guys that work for me. I try to take care of the guys that stood duty section with me, those kind of things. You know, when you're, you know, if you stand watch aft or if you're standing CDO or whatever, you know, that you just, you have to try to set expectations. You have to try to kind of manage and read each person. I've told guys that work under me or whatever, like JOs when they come on the boat, and you know, I can tell you, I've seen every gamut of leadership there is, the ones that work, the ones that don't, the ill-mannered, ill-advised JO that walks on the boat and says, "I'm an officer, you're enlisted, and you're going to do what I tell you." That guy's doomed. He's gone. And we had a guy that was like that on Wyoming when I was a JO, and literally his watch section and maneuvering would not talk to him. They wouldn't talk amongst themselves. They would hold no conversations so that he couldn't join in their conversations. They would sit silently for 6 hours and only repeat phone, you know, incoming, outgoing phone, you know, orders or whatever, reports and stuff like that, because that's how they, that was their way of dealing with it. And, you know, my last CO on Greenville was a little Napoleon screamer guy and get in your face. And he got his jollies by making you nervous and run off flustered and run off. And literally, I mean, being a little facetious, but you could hand him a report. He would say, "I wanted it in red ink," throw it back at you, yell and scream. You'd walk away and go make it red ink. He'd turn to the people next to him and go, "I have to do every one of his reports." And, you know, I've always got to fix issues, you know, and it'd be something trivial like that. And he's why I didn't stay in being XO, because the day I checked off board, his conversation with me was, "After midterm counseling, you're going to be a great XO. Everybody loves you." When I checked off board, it was, "Hey, I wouldn't have wanted you as my XO, so I'm not going to let you be anyone." So he, you know, took that X out of that fit rep bullet that says your XO recommended, and that's your end of your submarine career. So, you know,
man, that's so unfair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's literally one person controls the fate of an entire ship of people. Careers. He forced a lot of guys that were great sailors to opt to get out of the Navy because they didn't ever want to have to deal with somebody like him, you know. Side note,
you know, it'd be nice. But you know, it'd be nice, like, if amongst your peers that you have and the JOs, you know, if they can make some kind of recommend towards your XOCO pipeline too, you know, then you get it kind of a different look. So one thing I wanted to ask you, because leadership is kind of a big thing here with me lately, you know, I don't know if you know John Rennie, he runs a business with electrical stuff. Different type construction. I'm starting to call him. Yeah, he's like leadership Jesus is what I'm calling him, you know, because he's taken the type of leadership we learned on a submarine and put it into practice, you know, with his business, and all his peers can't figure out why, you know, he does so much better than him. So you have a construction business, and you know, because I watched some of your posts you have on there from time to time, and you know, you're interviewing with like the city council and stuff like that, have you brought those leadership skills to your construction company, and how well is that doing for you?
Well, so remodel construction, that kind of thing. I mean, it's booming right here, especially now as interest rates go up and people aren't selling. Now they're starting to rebuild and remodel, whatever. I try to ensure that, one, you know, you take care of your guys, you know, you pay them well, you try and take care of them, but you also try to instill in them the fact that they need to be autonomous amongst themselves as well, too. So 6 guys now, 2 crews that run, so I'm running 2 job sites at once, you know, at any time, but you try to get them to develop into managing their own work sites. So you make a leader out of them instead of just 3 individuals on a site doing, you know, doing different things, because as a business manager, I can't sit on a job site day to, you know, day in, day out or whatever, because I've told the guys, because one or two of them had tried to at one point or another leave and go and do their own thing, right? Thinking it's, you know, kind of easy, but they're builders, and it's like you can't be hammering all day on a job site and gaining the jobs that you need to support you and your family for the next 3, 6, 9 months or whatever, right? Because you can't get out and meet customers and stuff. So, you know, lessons learned, things you've learned over the years in the military, and how to just deal and read people. There's no two people are the same, right? You've got to read individual based on how they respond to, you know, you got the ones that want you to scream at them. You got the ones that want you to be stern. You got the ones who, if you do that, they'll shut down. So you got to figure that out, you know, over time as you get to know your guys to figure out how to manage each individual person.
Kind of thing. I'm curious, going back to your CO and some other, and some of those comments right there, when you got picked up for the officer program, what do they teach you as an officer candidate about that? I mean, the second class, I went to LMET school, which I thought was invaluable. I will tell you that the day I went to LMET, I was a different second class petty officer than the day I graduated. Two weeks and changes everything. What do they teach you in officer candidate school about those, especially us second classes? I know I'm a first now, wasn't first, but I consider myself to be a second class. It still says second. So what do they teach you?
So that whole transition was the enlisted commissioning program was a little different, right? I mean, the ROTC scholarships that you could have gotten picked up as, you know, out of boot camp and stuff like that. The enlisted commissioning program, you had to have at least 6 to 8 years already time in. So I was a first class, you know, electrician or whatever. And so they're developing, I'll say senior, some people out there may non-nuke rates would think that a 8-year first class is not very senior, but you know, in the nuke world, you kind of are, but, you know, so you've got people who've been in and understand and that kind of thing, but it transitions you into how to manage the rank structures, right? So you have classes on leadership techniques, just like LMET was, and all took as an electrician going from, you know, third to second, second to first. And once you get, you know, once you start taking the chief's exam and stuff like that, just different classes and stuff. But it forces you to understand better the relationships between junior officers and more senior officers to the chief's quarters down to, you know, the enlisted ranks and E6 and below and stuff. And I don't know. I was fortunate, I guess. I grew up under some great COs who taught you the value of valuing the guys that work for you, right?
Well, my
CO in Wyoming was Jeff Hughes, and probably the best CO I ever worked for. Jeff was a guy who had a little yellow sticky. I never forget the first time I noticed it. He had a yellow sticky on his underway desk in his stateroom, and it said, "Who have you asked how their day's going today?" Right? And literally that was him. He walked through the boat. He talked to guys. He checked on them, made it personable, right? Instead of just, you know, the CO's coming and the guys duck for cover and that kind of thing. You know, he was very personable. Transferred to prototype with him up in Boston Spa. He transferred off the boat same time I did, was the CO of prototype up there, and followed him, and very fortunate to have about 6 fit reps with his signature on it, because he was a great man. He, you know, still is, obviously. He's retired now. But
So what do you think happens? What do you think goes different? Because that was my understanding. There's got to be some teaching of this stuff. What goes different when you end up with a CO who is saying things like you were talking about earlier. What happened to that person, in your opinion, because obviously you're not going to know specifically, but what do you think changes in that?
They're probably a product of one, how you raised, you know, how your relationship growing up, how you're treated and those kind of things. But they probably had COs that were similar in style to them. You know, you get the difference in the, you know, the great COs and then the ones who basically run a ship into the, not literal ground, but they run a crew into the ground. Right. You get that difference and they make or break. I mean, you read all the Navy Times articles about COs that are relieved and, you know, issues and what's the term?
Loss of confidence.
That's it. Loss of confidence in basically how they manage their crew and that kind of stuff, you know? So, you know, like I was saying, you know, it was the guy's name that I had on Greenville, the one that, you know, the XO recommendation thing. Alan Dorbecker was his name. He is, I love to tell people this, you know, karma is a big thing, right? He's federal prison because Alan decided in Italy that a 15-year-old girl that worked at the library was the love of his life and started sending her nice little emails and professing his love. And a bunch of the guys on the boat found and sent out the transcripts to other guys on the boat. And it was nothing dirty, wrong.
Isn't that interesting?
It was very poetic, but turns out both her parents were the NCIS agents in Italy. And so from email one, they had her account. She never read anything. And after a pretty long period of time, they set up the little meet. Hey, my parents are out of town. You can come to the house. And old Alan knocked on the door with flowers in his hand, and NCIS took him away. So, hey, you know, he's in California right now. Maybe he gets to see this. And if he does, if I ever saw him, I'd love to tell him, you got me out of the Navy, and I ended my submarine career, but I'm retired. You're not.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's shift gears here a little bit. Let's pick your navigator brain.
Okay.
I'm an FTB, Eric's missile tech. I'm ancient. When I left the boat 40 years ago. So things have changed. Things are different now. But some things remain the same. Deck watching, seamanship, those kind of things. Next deck watching. So we read the Connecticut report, and I went ballistic. I don't know how Eric would describe him, but I'm still appalled that not one person on that ship said, we're going really fast with no fathometer. Nobody said it. Not a single person.
Yep.
As a navigator, what do you do?
You know, there are standing orders for a purpose. There are rules of I don't want to say engagement, but there are, you know, the CO, XO, navigator, you establish guidelines, and the Navy has its own guidelines too. Without a fathometer and in known charted areas, this, that, and the other, you cannot exceed certain depths and do certain speeds based off of the fact that you don't have that bottom sounding to find something you missed, right? So
now the report also said something about the, you know, like the CEOs of this special projects group, you know, they're kind of like Top Gun, best of best. So they get a little bit more leeway than other commanding officers do. So, I mean, what's your thought on that? Being, because you were in the parts, you probably same group or something like it. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, they do. I mean, they are, but they're held to a higher standard, though. I mean, yeah, so you get some leeway. That leeway is more along the lines of, hey, when you're out in Indian territory, you've got to manage your ship and come home safe but carry the mission out. Not, hey, I'm transiting in open waters and, you know, I've got to get there. So heck with it. I'm going to just put the pedal down and run without all these safety measures kind of thing. The issue.
Third field day.
Right. So Dave, you were talking about, you know, nobody said anything, right? So it's the same thing, right? So, San Francisco hitting, you know, running aground, hitting an underwater mountain kind of thing. anybody question that little dark spot that popped up on the chart that was on, you know, so the whole BMS system and going away from paper charts and stuff, yeah, it makes it easy to click a bunch of buttons and it auto highlights different depths and this, that, and the other, and X number of feet or whatever off the shoreline, and, you know, off fathometer curves and stuff like that. But nobody questioned there. When Greenville did the emergency blow under the Hemi Maru, that the sonar junior second class who heard something, he didn't speak up, because if you don't have the command culture to tell, to everybody has to understand that if they question something, they have the ability to bring it up. You got to bring it up properly, but
right.
If you don't breathe that into your command, you're doomed to fail. And you're going to have somebody that does
that. Is that what's wrong with the Navy as a whole? Because it was drilled into me. Captain Frank Mark Conway III sat with me one day and drilled it into me that this is as much my ship as it was his. The only difference is he signed for it, I didn't. And that I had every bit as much responsibility for the safety of that ship as he did. And I don't know. I mean, my first dive, I almost called away flooding because it was the potable water tanks were leaking. But the bottom line is, it seems to me Navy-wide, Fitzgerald, Greenville, Connecticut, on and on and on. It seems like there's a culture in the Navy where the sailor, the junior sailors, the second classes, the first classes, and I hesitate to say this because somebody's going to say, hey, Dave, you're lumping everybody, you're painting with a broad brush. But it seems like nobody's taking that personally. This is my ship. This is my home. I'm responsible for it. And if I see something wrong, I damn well better say something.
Right. It goes back to command climate. It really does. If you're not teaching, like you said, the CO teaching you that, if you're not instilling those thought processes into everybody that's on your ship, then they're not going to say something out of, you know, whether it's out of fear, whether it's just uncertainty, whether it's whatever. But if there's something you just don't think is correct, you at least have to question it to someone above you.
How do we fix
it? Give the opportunity, right?
How do we fix this?
Well, I got a quick question, Dave, from the audience. I got a question from the audience. Let me get that out of the way. And then it says, this is from Mr. Bade, who we know. Were those CEOs more prevalent during the Rickover era or less so after the Rickover was no longer involved? What's your thoughts on that?
Which type CO? The good ones or the bad?
It's hard to get what he's talking about, but was there a difference in culture between CEOs that were, you know, were under Rickover and ones that are not?
I think that era probably had more of the CEOs that were dictatorial kind of thing. They were more of what I experienced on Greenville toward the end than what I experienced on Wyoming with Jeff Hughes. Because back then it was more, the Navy was a little more, you know, result driven, those kind of things. When I first came in, we didn't have near as many training sessions that involved management styles and leadership styles and you know, the proper way to manage people. The Navy's invested a lot of money. When I was at SubPac, the Navy's put a lot of money into bringing in outside successful business and entrepreneurs and their management styles and try to curb those into the submarine culture and the surface culture or whatever, to try to instill in the leadership better ways of dealing with people, because it's harder. I mean, when we went in and, you know, before and for some short period afterwards, I hate to say it, it's a different sailor that's going in the Navy today compared to the sailor that we were going in. You know, I don't want to say, I mean, everybody, there's always going to be great guys that have great work ethic, but it's harder today. You can't manage the way, you can't run roughshod over a division like people probably did back then compared to now, because so many kids are just shut down. They've never had to deal with it. They, you know, this is the culture that grows up with, you know, my mom chased me with every yard implement in the world if she thought I was doing something wrong. And, you know, you whippings and stuff like that when you're little and you do something wrong. The kids today don't have that. So they don't know how to deal with the harsh reality of someone that is trying to correct their actions and stuff, especially if you get that leader that's in your face, kind of, this is wrong, you did this wrong, you know, those kind of things. And so I think you have to kind of do it differently. So you can't really have those cowboys, if you will. You just got to manage people better. That's all there is to it. You know, you just got to spend more time on those management techniques.
That's a good point because, you know, as society changes and the way kids are being brought up, obviously the military has to move with that and right. learn how to manage that properly and right. turn them into what they need them to be. So that's a good point.
On the news front, Eric, I will tell you that there was a, I don't know what to call it, kind of ship to call it. It's not a barge, but it looks like a barge with a tugboat bow. And a big tugboat, and it has this big flat section behind it. And it was carrying what appeared to be a submarine nose cone into Bremerton this week.
Wonder what that could be for.
Well, you know, so when you have three ships in a class and all three of them are still operational and you shut down the production of spare parts, my guess is they've ramped up the manufacturing backbone to create the bow of a submarine, of a Connecticut type submarine, would be my guess.
But that tells us they're going to repair it. They're not, because there was a lot of noise about whether or not they would just decommission her because she was badly bit. But I do know this. I was down at PSNS a few weeks ago driving by. I was there for the Oklahoma City decommissioning. And as you drove by the dry docks, you could see here's the Oklahoma City and the Providence in a dry dock. Here's four submarines that I don't have any idea who are, various stages of disassemble. And here's this one dry dock that's completely covered. You can't see nothing. So we know she's there, but they're probably there, I assume.
Every time Parchy went in the dry dock before we flooded down or basically pumped down all the water in dry dock, we had to attach rigging off the normal everyday view part of the hull, so that as the water recessed, all the big naugahyde big tarps would fall and cascade, so that you couldn't see anything underneath the ship and
nothing to see like anyway. Right? I mean, it's 1960s. It's nothing to see anyway. It's 1960s technology. It's an old boat. There's nothing to see here.
Yeah. You're right. Nothing to see.
What do you like most about your career? What was the best part of your career, Dave?
Parchy was something special. That crew and people, obviously every single person that went to that boat had a top secret clearance. Every single crew member had to get screened by, you know, background investigations, stuff like that. But you were handpicked and stuff. So you, every single rate on that ship, you only had the best of whether it's coming out of A school, or whether it's sea returnees that are coming back to sea again. So you had a lot of the best of the best on the boat kind of thing. So that makes a difference, right? So your whole entire crew, not to say we didn't have guys that were problem children, because we did. We went through a rash in 90, 91 where it became evident that if you turned yourself reported, self-reported that you were on drugs or something like that, they would let you off the boat and you weren't penalized and this, that, and the other. And we had I think he was an FT. Anyway, forward rate. He just had re-enlisted, just got his bonus, had been doing a bunch of sea lawyering and found out they couldn't take the bonus back, turns himself in. And when he did it, we had about five guys behind him that did the same thing. But we had two guys that were totally special. Sonar Tech and a quartermaster that waited until the brow was lifted off for a 4-week underway to go tell the cob that they'd been smoking marijuana. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's nice. A way to get y'all off of the boat, right? No, they were laundry queens, and I had the hot rack together, and they were put on watch at the same time so that technically they should be both sleeping at the same time. So every time they went to the rack, they fought each other, literally scrapping over who got the rack and who had to sleep on the floor in the bunker.
Also, the cop considered him like a security risk or something, huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't understand what I'm saying, watch, right? So, I mean, so we had some people that were like, no, Parchie was something else. It made me growing up on Parchie made me the leader I became. And you know, I loved it there. I mean, I love the officer side of it. I wouldn't trade any of that for the world. But Parchie was just special.
You're the third Parchie sailor that I've actually met, and all three of them say the same. And I'm assuming different eras. One was in the 60s, one was in the 80s, and now you. And it's interesting. Yeah, I remember that era of the Navy when it was like Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place or wasn't in place yet. But, you know, there was this mindset of, well, if I just say something, you know, so the first day I'm on the boat, very first day, walking through lower level, taking a tour with the guy I'm replacing, and I run into Chief Richard Long. Not making his name up, used to introduce himself as Chief Long, Dick. And he looked at me, the first words out of his mouth, Missile Tech Chief, first words out of his mouth was, Bowman, are you gay? I'm a third class non-qual, right? I don't know. I'm not. Well, come to find out, several of my predecessors had just decided that they didn't want to deal with this anymore. And so they'd go to the weapons officer and say, I'm gay. And they'd get out. And the last guy.
Of course, FTBs. I knew it. Anyway.
The last guy that pulled that, the weapons officer said, no, you're not. You're just making that up. So the next day he came in with Polaroids.
Oh, Lord.
Gay, I want out. And they still had the Polaroids on the back of the computer tour. So I assured Chief Long that I was not in fact gay.
Nice.
But that's, I remember that era very well.
We had that. There was a little bit of that too.
Yeah.
But you know, over the course of 23 years, you're always going to have those people that want to find out exactly how they can get past requirements or get out, or you know, the FTN guys and you know all that kind of stuff or whatever. But I told my guys all the time. I said, you're in. How you spend your time in is really up to you. You can make this the hardest thing you've ever done in your life, or you can try and excel, and you don't have to reenlist. Mm-hmm. You can just do your six or four or whatever it is, but get as much out of the Navy as you can, because they're going to take everything out of you that they need. And you know, so yeah, you know, I think over 23 years, after I got commissioned, so the last 13 years, I think I got probably 15 or so, maybe more guys commissioned. So I got them to going through packages and approved and that kind of thing to get commissioned.
Oh, yeah. Outstanding.
Some done their time and got out. I've been out 12 years now. So, you know, so I was always proud of that too, is trying to get guys to, you know, stay Navy, if you will, but not just stay Navy, not just reenlist, but advance their careers and take more from the Navy than what's out there. If you don't go looking, you're never going to know. So,
hey, David, I got a quick story. So I like what he said about, you know, the Navy's like a bi-directional thing, you know, they're going to take from you and you should take from it. You got to balance that out. And if you can learn to balance it out, well, the Navy really works out for you. But, you know, when we were making that transition to early 90s, so we were coming out of a period, not just the Navy, I mean, all the militaries coming out of Vietnam. I mean, all these guys were hooked on everything you can think of. I mean, marijuana, you mentioned LSD and God knows what, probably mushrooms too. So, you know, the Navy had to figure out how to make that transition. And it started right as me and you joined in 87, you know, because right. That's, you know, it seems like we were held more accountable than the people. But before us, and they gave them like a trial period, like a 2-year period. And like you said, kind of turn yourself in. If you don't, you know, it's going to be consequences. But, you know, that's not to put down the Navy in particular. I mean, as I said, that was a Vietnam thing. It was a very transitory, but here's a story I had. I can either confirm or deny. I'm not even going to bring up what boat and who the people were, but so the dehumidification plant for the missile tubes and the old 41 for freedom business was in the lower level. So the guys that were hooked on the marijuana, the Mary Jane, would go down there and smoke into the intake of the dehumidifier. So it would go into the missiles, circulate with the rocket fuel air when it come out. You couldn't tell. So
nice.
that was all. Yeah. And then you always had the guys too, you know, they're putting alcohol in the shampoo bottles and all that stuff. So you always have, you always had all, but I do like how, so you had, Dave is probably more clear about the clearances. So in the Swazi program for nuclear weapons, we had to have the 10-year investigations, the SSI, you know, you gave them 10 names and then they went and asked, well, who else did he know? Yeah, it's not nice to meet you, but who else did you know? And had a PRP personnel reliability program too. Did they have the PRP on the par sheet? Is that part of that?
I don't remember. I'm sure it was. I don't remember it back then. Right. I mean, we were PRP on Wyoming and that program was different than, you know, parts. I don't ever remember any kind of like PRP, you know, I don't remember any kind of training briefs, discussions, anything like that. They obviously did the background investigations and stuff because, you know, so I grew up in a trailer park in central North Carolina or whatever. And you know, these FBI agents start rolling in and knocking on doors up and down my road and, you know, all the little rumor mills are starting. What's he done? Hey, you know, what's David done? Because FBI agent knocked on my door and this, that, and the other kind of thing. Right. You know, So you start hearing all of that stuff and they do their investigations. They're very thorough. They find stuff and you get guys that, you know, guys that applied for programs and all of a sudden they find something. And even though they've been on the boat for a year, all of a sudden they go away. And, so it's good to see they do that kind of thing, but PRP program, I'm pretty certain, was a little different than the background stuff they did for Archie and Carter and stuff like that too. So
I was 18 when they started my investigation that went back 10 years. I don't even remember anything from when I was 8 years.
What did he do in grade school?
I played war games when I was in high school, you know, the Avalon Hill war games. And it was a war game that I played with my best friend and it involved the use of atomic weapons. Right. So you could nuke your opponent if you wanted to. And we always had these handshake agreements not to. And when I went to one of the DIS interviews or whatever, the guy's laughing. So, yeah, we talked to your best friend. He says, you know, the question was, can we trust you with nuclear weapons? Would you trust Dave with nuclear weapons? And his answer, he didn't even skip a beat. He's like, no. And he says, wait, is he in charge of him or is he just working on him? Because if he's in charge of him, don't let him know. Because he'll use them. Anyway, he thought that was funny. So going back to when I was 8 years old, I mean, it was kind of a blank slate, but it'd be a bit different now.
That's right. That's awesome.
So, yeah, just let this be a lesson to you. If you want to join the Navy and go into submarines, I mean, I call it underwater Star Trek. These guys got flat screen panels everywhere and, you know, it's fly-by-wire and even got the a PlayStation, a Sony joystick thing for the fiber periscope. I mean, it's crazy. So it's a great opportunity, but you know, you really got to think about what you're doing now as a teenager before you get in. So, you know, that kind of sets your career. So I wanted to segue real quick into what you're doing, which I think is fantastic. And it kind of goes into, you know, the shipbuilders, you know, for our new submarines, they just don't have enough skilled labor because there's nobody's trained. And, so you had a stepson, and I'm probably going to say his name wrong. You want to say it for me, please? Colby.
Colby Haithcott.
Colby. So he's got a website, the Colby Haithcott Foundation, and Colby was going to be an electrician. So, and kind of going along with the stories we're talking about, he did unfortunately have a DUI. I mean, surprise, like he's not the only teenager that did drinking in high school, but unfortunately, it ended his life. I think he had in the story we talked on one podcast, he had a friend with him. But Colby wanted to be an electrician. And a great thing you're doing with that foundation is you're always raising money to uh,
to, I think it's a local school or class for electricians. So, and you're always raising money to, for right. people to get some money to go to school, you know, finish your school.
So Kobe's dad was, is an electrical lineman. So that's what Kobe wanted to do pretty much, you know, all of his life. I knew him for 9 years before, you know, he died, made a bad choice, rode with another kid that was driving that was 0.18 alcohol. That kid wrecked, and but Kobe died from a result from the accident or whatever. So we started the Kobe Haycock Memorial Scholarship Fund. We provide $500 scholarships to a student from every graduating class now from three different community colleges here in North Carolina. About to pick up a fourth maybe. So we donate right now $5,000 a year, and through fundraisers and stuff. But yeah, I mean, it all goes back to the dirty jobs. That whole, Lord help. Now I'm not going to know his name.
Mike Rowe.
Yeah, who does dirty jobs?
Mike Rowe.
Yeah. Mike Rowe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike Rowe's got a couple of videos out there where he talks about it, the lack of skilled labor. And you know, you go to the whole debacle of whether or not we should be paying off college loans and stuff like that, that the government's kind of bandying about way too much.
Amen, you know, brother.
People were being, for years, people were told you got to go to college. And they go to college and get worthless degrees that won't get them a job and, you know, those kind of things. Meanwhile, the trades are losing knowledge. Everyone is aging out of a lot of programs and a lot of places, and you just don't have it. I mean, there's a lot of good kids that are trying to do it, and the three schools we're at, those classes are full, but I'm telling you, the power companies are hiring pretty much anybody that gets through those schools because they have to replace an aging workforce. And so, you know, we try, we kind of deem it living Kobe's dream and try to help them out and that kind of thing. But yeah, you're right. I mean, same thing everywhere. It's like, how do you get the right skill set growing up? I mean, Lord help, kids can't write in cursive and don't know how to balance a checkbook when they come out of high school now, right?
Well, yeah, decided not to write in cursive until I was much older. So if somebody's interested in this and in participating in this, either as a donor or a recipient, how do they find out more information?
Facebook has Kobe Haycock Memorial Scholarship Fund. There is, I tell you, the biggest thing, hey, if you're out there listening and you're an Amazon shopper and you're not using Amazon Smile, okay, it's literally smile.amazon.com. It's a charity wing of Amazon. They basically donate pennies off the dollar towards a charity. Doesn't cost you anything more when you buy all the stuff you buy on Amazon, but you get to select a charity to donate to. And Kobe Haycock Memorial Scholarship Fund is a selectable charity. I'd love everybody out there listening and watching to select that through Amazon Smile. If not, and you have another charity you're kind of personal with, do that, okay? Because it makes a difference in, you know, every penny, every dollar helps us and other charities do stuff, especially small time charities like we are or whatever. But you know, we're doing good, and we're, like I said, we're about to add a fourth community college in North Carolina. I think there's nine in the state, and if I could hit all nine with checks because I had enough donors and sponsors and stuff, we would. So
can you spell that for me? Sorry.
Kobe is Kolby Haycock, HAITHCOCK, the Memorial Scholarship Fund.
Perfect.
Great.
Thank
stuff.
You. So we don't have a lot of time left, but let's talk about construction for just a minute. Okay. How'd you get into that? You're an electrician's mate in the Navy, and then you're an officer, a navigator. Yeah. Yeah. What leads you into construction?
Well, so I did, post-Navy, most of the jobs that I had were all like maintenance manager type jobs. I did construction management for a little over 2 years. A friend of mine growing up, a bit younger than me, was a mechanical engineer, started a company, construction management. You just kind of oversee job sites and, you know, keep all the different trades coming in, you know, kind of focused on the end result and keep them going, right, meet deadlines and stuff. Did that for a couple years. I was asked, I worked, the last job I had before I started this, I worked for a company called Symbotic. They're a robotics warehousing company. Little robot cars pick boxes up, stick them in their belly, drive into the storage racks and store boxes. And then when a store needs a pallet of whatever, it picks all the boxes up, makes a pallet, goes to a store kind of thing. Walmart at the time had two test facilities. I was in a dairy deli place in North Carolina, the retail one in Florida, which was great. You could make a pallet and went straight from the truck straight to the aisle, but you can't do that in dairy deli. So they killed our facility, right? They bought $40, $30 million systems, and they've since bought a bunch more. But our job was ending, and a friend of mine was a subcontractor out here where I'm at now, wanted to get a general contractor's license. So general contractor's license, open book test. I'm a 23-year nuke. You give me a stack of books and time to study them, and they let you tab them up and that kind of thing. And it works out to where you get about 3 minutes a question to flip through the right book and find the answer and that kind of thing. So I got the license for him and moved out here. You don't mix money and friendship. I'll just leave it at that. We split. And, you know, he didn't think because I'm not a carpenter. I didn't grow up, you know, hammering nails. I didn't build and, you know, all that kind of stuff, but I'm a manager, right? So I'm good with people. I can manage a company and make money and meet clients and customers and stuff like that and hire the right people. So the six guys I got know what they're doing. I know what they're doing. It's just, I don't have the hands-on background they do, but so, you know, once you're already relocated and living somewhere, and we moved out here too. My wife, after Colby's death, wanted to get away from where we're from, so she wanted to come out here. So, you know, we had to make it work and started my own company, hired the right guys. You liaison with your customers and you treat your customers right, and you show up when you say you will, and you do what you say you're going to do, and you know, and you manage their money well and those kind of things. 95% of my business is referral. I get calls every day because somebody told somebody, and hey, if you need your house remodeled, call this guy. And, you know, so a little bit of a around your elbow, get from thumb to your pinky kind of deal to get into this career. But I love it. You know, I love helping people. Mm-hmm. Envision their dreams of what they want their home to look like and that kind of stuff.
Helping people and doing the next right thing goes a long way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I've got customers that after the last hurricane that hit here, we fixed their house. And, you know, I had three houses within one block on the beach that were all supposed to sell 3 days after the last hurricane. And you got to run in there and basically put them all back together and get them back on the market so the families can sell. And, you know, you do that and people start telling other people kind of thing, you know. And out here in Oak Island, it's it's sky's the limit if you just, you know, like I said, if you're honest and do the job you're saying you're going to do and show up on time, makes a world of difference out here. So there's your military background, right? I'm going to be here at this time. Here's the path I'm going to take to get there. This is what we're going to do. And you meet deadlines and you meet schedules and you lay out a plan and, you know, you just make it work. And thankfully the military background and that leadership and management or whatever, kind of plays into that.
And letting people be autonomous too. That goes a long way.
Right.
So hey, I got two. Go ahead, Doug.
Dave, because I know we're running out of time. So I got two other things. When he's not fundraising and raising money for future electricians, doing great stuff like that, run a construction company. He managed to write two books, and he sent me copies of these. You know, you got the, I don't know if you can see this on the count, keep the Silent Service. So it's like a 2-volume set. And he's also got Lethal Intentions. And I think you've got those on the Colby Aycock's website, and you can also get them on Amazon. And we're going to put links to the show edit, you know, after this. So, you know, he autographed these things, and I'm really thankful for it, but I have to confess, I've had a lot of drama the last 2 years that, you know, if you keep in my Facebook, you would know. And just having a day would say that, well, Poseidon MTC3 guys just don't know how to read. Well, we know how to read stuff. If it's crayons involved, you know, if there's crayons, we're good to go. But, you know, he was there. He's an instructor. He could tell you. But, no, I'm really thankful for this. You know, I'm going to catch up with these books. I'm reading, you know, Leadership Jesus book over here, and I'm getting a lot of good stuff out of that, you know, with managing leadership, a lot of stuff we talked about today. So, yeah, you got anything else, Dave?
Yeah, I want to know about this book. I'm surprised. I went to Amazon to Keep Silent Service, Volume 1. And turns out that I bought this book some time ago, and I guess I just haven't read it. I don't remember buying it, but apparently I did.
There you go.
So at least you got paid. Right? Yeah,
man. Well, yeah, but you're making money.
I'm intrigued by this. This idea here, because it says the president isn't sure if we're going to launch Viper. He's not sure if we're going to carry that out. You know, that's the number one question I get asked as an FTB. Would you have launched? And the answer is always, yeah. I mean, I've 35 years ago when I was doing this, I don't know that I would have thought about it. I'd have just done it. Nowadays, I'd still do it, but at least I'd think about it. So, right.
That's kind of the whole. Go ahead.
Well, what caused this premise in your mind? Because obviously you were walking around USS Wyoming going, here's a plot for a book.
Well, it was actually, I've always felt like I had a book in me somewhere, kind of thing. I'm a big supporter of women on board. Okay. Submarines, bringing them into the submarine force or whatever. Other countries do it. They're very successful. So that me book too. Involves that. So Keep Silent Service involves a, females on board, that kind of thing, some of the problems they have or whatever. And Wyoming, the book is about Wyoming because I was on Wyoming. Book two is about Greenville because I was on Greenville. It's a big supporter of that. And then, the whole fact that in this world you can reach out and know people in Russia, know people in China, you know, Facebook, right? You can have friends for everywhere as long as you verify they're not scams and stuff like that. But so the world is connected now. It used to not ever be. And you know, so the premise that the thought came up that if asked to launch, how many people on board the ship would know somebody that would be initially affected by it? We'd all know somebody with the follow-up effects. But so that was the premise of that. And without giving too much of the book away, it's basically a test. And you guys know, what'd you do when Riders came on the boat? Your CO made you
exactly
wear
the same, exactly the same thing that you always did.
Yes. Well, you did your job, but you couldn't wear tennis shoes. You had to wear your boots. You had to wear your dress poopy suits, as they call them nowadays. You know, you couldn't grow the beard. You had to do all these things. Maybe back in your day, because you were probably back still when that stuff. But all my time, if anybody was on board, you didn't get to grow the beard out. You know, you had to be presentable and be Navy, right? So if you had a rider, if they sent you out to sea and there were riders on board, you would know it was a test. So one of the officers on the boat is an actual licensed psychologist that was asked and goes through the whole entire officer pipeline and qualifies on board as a JO and qualifies, gets her gold dolphins kind of deal. And then this test happens. And
wow,
the premise is that the boat doesn't know they're carrying test missiles, and they don't know that they can't actually launch true nuclear weapons, and they are getting messages like it's real world scenario. And then the premise of the, you know, you go through the book of people who want to just launch because that's your job, and the people who don't want, what happens, and those kind of things. Come up with some sci-fi-ish weapons and different things that are, you know, not real, to make it a fictional story, and those kind of those things. Right into book one, go into book two, so they're together.
I'll bet there's some lines that you had to kind of, you know.
I would never write a story that involved USS Parchy for fear that people would think that what I make up in my mind may or may not have been true and start. Side note, so I sent my books to Admiral Wackendorf, and I've got an open invite, and I just got to make it happen to come to D.C. and talk to him, because he said he can never write a book because of his experience in Special Projects Platform. But he has a lot of ideas for fictional books and stuff like that. And so at some point I'm going to take the time, go up and sit down with him, and maybe start ghostwriting or writing books and use his ideas for the kind of plot lines for him or whatever. So
I think you should, Dave. I think you should head up there and take a week. And of course, then you got to leave your business for a week, and then you got to trust those second class petty officer types to run things for you.
Right. That's right.
You know how that goes.
I leave them enough. I've been around, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been a Rams fan all my life, and I travel to football games and stuff like that, and I go places, and you know, so I leave them with, hey, here's what I need you to come, you know, get done while I'm gone, and I may or may not be able to answer the phone, so you got to kind of make that happen. So I leave them enough.
How does a guy with a Southern accent like you've got become a Rams fan?
No team in the 70s whenever I was finding a football team to follow. And my brother and I thought that Jack and Jim Youngblood were true brothers on the same team, so we selected the Rams and been a Ram fan all my life. Mm. Matter of fact, I don't know if you see it, but when I turn my laptop, there's all my figurines and Ram stuff.
Oh, there you go.
Jack Youngblood, so –
somewhere in a box somewhere, I have a Dieter Brock jersey.
Nice.
But I don't know where it is. I'm one of the few people that even remember him. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dave, it's been great talking to you. Eric, you got anything you want to add in?
No. I mean, this has been a fantastic interview. So I think you guys are one of Fast Sack. I think we covered just about everything. And, of course, Dave Anderson, Lieutenant Commander Dave Anderson, is welcome to come back at any time. And we, you know, when we have situations come up in the news and stuff, we'll probably have him come back and we'll discuss that, you know, with all his experience. I mean, I have a similar background, trailer park, you know, great men that kind of helped form me as a kid and a teenager. Dave as well, you know, coming up from the South. So I can really feel how Dave's career went. So he just went off, sir, and I went to No. 2 and got in a car accident. But, you know, we all got our fate, you know. So, no, we really appreciate you being on. So you can find us right now if you're watching live. It's on Facebook.com/group/thesubvet, and you can find us at the subvet/Twitter/thesubvet. I always get this wrong.
Twitter.com/thesubvet.
And then thank you, Dave. Then you can also get me at thesubvet.com. Go there. Hey, check it out. I'm opening up a merch line. I got just a few things, you know, and definitely check out the Dave's stuff too at the Colby Health Foundation. I think he's got a store there. He's got some cool stuff that you want to buy. And definitely, if you can, you got a few extra bucks. I know the economy's tight. See if you can donate towards, you know, that great school scholarship foundation he's got. But no, that's all I got, Dave. And like I said, Dave Anderson, Lieutenant Commander, I really appreciate you being here. It was a great interview, great time. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
I really appreciate it. Side note, submarinebrotherhoodapparel.com is the website where I sell all my submarine stuff. Okay. Amazon for the books. That web, the Submarine Brotherhood Apparel has the books also if you want an autographed version. Again, you know, I really appreciate it. My wife would tell you, I'll sit and tell Navy stories forever. So, you know, you're looking to fill another camera slot on there and somebody to talk about something, give me a call. I always love to sit and talk. So thank you for having me.
All right. And,
David probably forgot, though. He is the only authorized merchant besides me on the Subvet Crew. He probably forgot he can post the stuff once in a while.
There you go. Don't forget to do it. All right, Eric, we're going to try this again. We screw this up every week.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm Fire Control Technician, Ballistic Missile First Class, Submarine Qualified Dave Bowman. You can get me at DolphinDave@SlipperyFish.com.
And I'm Missile Technician Second Class, Submarine Qualified Eric Ryle. And you can get me at Eric@TheSubVet.com.
And we are...
One, two, three, the Subvet!
Come on, Dave, one more time. We can do it one more time. You ready? One, ready? Hey, Dave, you can join in. I count to three. One, two, three. The Subvet!